Well, good morning. My name is James Harper. I'm one of the elders here at Christ Pres, and just want to welcome you to Adult Sunday School on this cloudy Sunday morning. But we are glad you are here. And this summer we've been going through a series, a very practical series called Held in Trust. And really, it's talking about the topic of faith, money, generosity, and stewardship. So this is the final lecture or class in that series. And so excited you're here. Today, we want to kind of take a long view of stewardship, a long view of dealing with money, and talk about a legacy worth leaving, a legacy worth leaving your children. So as we get started, let's go to the next slide. Let's start with what Proverbs has to say about inheritances. A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children, Proverbs 13:22. And of course, when we hear this verse, we tend to think about money or property or accounts. But an inheritance is even more than just stuff. It's more than property. It can be values. It can be order. It can be peace. It can be clarity. Things that you can give to your family that will help them feel better when you, when something goes wrong with you, as far as when you're disabled or incapacitated and can't handle your financial affairs, or when you have a need to make a serious, you know, decision about your health and life support and feeding tubes and things of that nature. If you're in the hospital and your family's wondering what to do and the doctor's kind of leaving it up to them. Or, you know, we're mortal. We are going to pass away. And so we again, looking at things from a long view, we want to make sure that we plan for the future. Plan for our surviving spouse. How are they going to be taken care of? You know, if we had children, especially minor children, who's going to be their guardian? You know, and that's just not automatic. There's things we can do to protect those decisions and make that happen. So stewardship doesn't end with the decisions we make while we're here. It extends to the decisions we've already made on behalf of the people who will be left holding things together. So let's go to the next slide. So think of legacy again, legacy being more than just, you know, stuff. It can be how you leave things, how you order things. And here's the main point of really today's lecture, or Sunday school class, is if you don't decide what your legacy looks like, someone else will decide for you. It can be a judge, you know, especially with guardianship issues. It can be intestacy statutes, Mississippi statutes that the legislature came up with that tell what happens to your property if you don't have a will or you don't have any beneficiary designations. It can be a family argument around a kitchen table, you know. That could be your legacy if you don't make certain preparations. So we're going to talk about five essential things to think about in leaving a legacy, a better legacy for our children and our family. And we'll talk about all five of these in some detail. And look, I am an attorney. I can get in the weeds in some of this stuff, and I don't want to. I'm going to try to take a high view and just kind of let you know about certain things that you ought to be thinking about. But again, I just want to flag some things for you that can kind of get you thinking about certain things that can help you. So we'll talk about a will. We'll talk about beneficiary designations and what that entails. We'll talk about powers of attorney, which to me personally right now, dealing with my parents, that's extremely important, something that I'm using. And I can tell you from working inside a bank, we're seeing a lot of powers of attorney right now. People are having to use powers of attorney to deal with their parents' finances, so or their spouse's finances when they're unable to. We're also going to talk about healthcare directives. There's a Mississippi statute directly on point that gives us some clarity there. And then probably the most important thing we'll talk about at the end is the family conversation. This is where you drive home the legacy portion of it. And, you know, it's good. You can have all four of these documents done, all four of these things done, but if nobody knows where your will is, if nobody knows where your power of attorney is, you know, if nobody knows about your other designations, you know, some of this can be useless, okay? You know, because they're still scrambling. And, you know, if something happens, they're trying, you know, they don't have time to deal with the grief because they got physical issues they got to deal with. They're panicking about, you know, what's going to happen to the children? You know, how's mom going to be taken care of? What do I do if, you know, they're on life support and we're stuck on life support? So, you know, it's good to have these conversations with your trusted family members. So, you know, and again, you can leave a legacy of not only just having these documents, but really having a good relationship with them and helping them avoid issues in the future. Let's see. Why don't we go to the first? We'll start talking about wills. Again, just a high level. What it is, this is the document. How many have a will? Raise your hand. Okay, that's good. This is the document that says who gets what, who takes care of your minor children. This also designates the person that you trust the most to handle your affairs when you're gone or you're not able to. So this is a very important document. Everybody needs to have a will, even if you have a trust in some other documents, and I'll explain why. But this also, you know, one of the important things a will does, it handles your residuary estate. You know, some of you may have a trust because you want to avoid probate, and that's great and all, but sometimes you forget to put certain property in a trust. So you want that will as a backup to handle any residuary stuff, to make sure you decide and not a court or a judge or the legislature what happens to your property. You know, and the mistake many people make is I'm too young, or my family will just figure it out, or things of that nature, or I'll just wait. But the problem is if you do wait, it may be, you may run out of time. Now, I've had several people over the years, I get the phone message on my office machine, and it's, hey, this is Jill, we're heading to the airport, you know, we're going on our first vacation without our young kids, but I meant to come by your office to do a will, and sorry, but hey, here's what we want to happen. If you can make sure our children go with my sister and not his sister, you know. And I just, you know, it's sad because, you know, it's too late. We don't have anything in writing. We can't get it properly attested or anything. And so it's great to have your intentions recorded on a voicemail, but that's not legal. That's not going to help. So, having that will is extremely important. And again, you'd be surprised if you don't have a will what the intestacy laws of the state of Mississippi will do. You know, for instance, you know, if you intended your surviving spouse to get everything, if you don't have a will, they're not necessarily going to get it everything. You know, in Mississippi, they'll get a child's share. So if you had three children and a surviving spouse, they're only going to get a quarter of your estate. And you intended them to have 100% of the estate. Okay, so that's a very good reason to not depend on the intestacy laws to dictate where your things go. Another mistake people make is, hey, I don't have enough to need a will, or my family will just figure it out. Again, even if you have a small estate, it's, you know, it's better to have a will to just make sure nothing goes wrong, and it eases some frustration that your family could have, you know, during that time period. So, and you can get a simple will, and they're fairly inexpensive. Most attorneys will do it for, you know, just a few hundred dollars, but it's worth the time and effort to go to your local attorney, you know, to have them help you draft a will and also to execute a will properly. Let's go to the next slide. Yeah, the components of a simple will. In these, you declare that this is you. In order to have a proper will that's legal, you have to declare that this is your last will and testament. You have to be 18 years or older and of sound mind. And a lot of times your will should revoke any prior wills, and codicil is a fancy word for an amendment to a prior will. Also in wills, you have family and beneficiaries that you identify. You know, it's good to identify your spouse, your children, and your other beneficiaries. You also direct that your debts and expenses, your funeral expenses and all your debts should be handled through your estate. Because that's how the estate is probated. And then, of course, very important, you list your specific gifts or your bequest. You know, if you have certain things you want to go to certain people, this is the document to put it in. And then you try to be as clear and detailed as you can when it comes to those specific bequests. And then after that, all wills have what's called a residuary clause, where all the rest of your property will be divided, you know, go between these people. It could be to your surviving spouse, and then beyond that to your children equally. And also too, a very important part of it names an executor. This is kind of like the quarterback. Your executor is the one that definitely should have a copy of your will, should know where your will is located. They're the ones that, you know, once you pass away, they're the ones that are going to read your will, and they're going to take it to a local attorney's office and hire them to help probate your will and kind of, you know, go through your assets and your debts and go through the estate process. And again, the estate process usually takes about, you know, 4 to 5 months at its quickest. But you need a good executor that you can trust. And also execution and witnesses are very important. You know, if you try to do a homemade will and sign it yourself, you're probably gonna run into some trouble. That's not gonna be legal. You have to have two witnesses. And they have to sign it at the end of the will. And also too, if you take it to an attorney's office, they'll make sure, a lot of times they'll do what's called a self-proving affidavit. And what that does is the witnesses, you know, they state what's happened during the execution of the will, and then they sign an affidavit to that, you know, testifying what happened. And with that document, you don't have to track them down years later when you're trying to probate the will. You can use that affidavit, and it makes probating will very simple, or a lot easier than having to track down witnesses from 20 to 30 years earlier. So, let's see if I got. Let's see. All right, let's go to the next slide. Sometimes not everybody has a will. Sometimes you do have a small estate. Sometimes people intentionally don't want to deal with a will. They don't want to go to probate. And so they'll do everything they can to avoid the cost and the expense and the slowness of going through probate to transfer property upon the death of someone. So there are some alternatives, and I just want to identify these. But again, I don't want you to lose the fact that the will is the best way to do things, but you also have these other alternatives. One is the small estate affidavit. Again, I see a lot of these at the bank. If you have a small estate that doesn't have real property and it's less than $75,000, you can actually use that small estate affidavit to transfer property, especially bank accounts. We see a lot of these at the bank. You have to wait 30 days, and you have to be one of the heirs, and you're stating under oath that, you know, you're stating who all the heirs are under oath. You also have transfer on death deeds is another way to transfer property. This is transfer real estate. This is a fairly new phenomena in the state of Mississippi. I don't think the statute is that old, but you can literally, this is a newer way to transfer real property, name a transfer on death designee on the deed itself, and it'll automatically, by law, get transferred upon the death of the last owner. I will say that I've talked to a real estate attorney about this one. Some attorneys are hesitant to use these, and it's mainly because the title insurance companies are still kind of, you know, getting on board with these. But at the older this law gets, I think we're going to see more and more the transfer on death deeds. So I just want you to know it's out there. It's worth asking your attorney about. There's also joint tenancy with rights of survivorship is another way to have, this is for real property. A lot of you spouses, you have your property designated like this. And so when the first spouse dies, it automatically, you know, stays with the surviving spouse. You don't need to do anything. So, also paid on death or transfer on death designations, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in just a second. You see these a lot with banks and annuities, like, and things of that nature. Revocable living trust. Mentioned those earlier. That's another way to transfer property outside the probate pathway. And minutement of title, this is when you have an estate that only has a real property in it, and you're just wanting to transfer that its property to the beneficiaries. This is a shortcut instead of going through probate. It's still, you have to go to court to do it, but it allows you to transfer property, but still you got to pay an attorney to do it, and it does take a little bit of time. So just want you to know that that's out there. Let's go to the next slide. Beneficiary designees, we talked about this. Usually you see these on life insurance policies, retirement accounts. You can do payable on death or transfer on death on bank accounts or brokerage accounts. So the important thing to remember about these is the will. Your will doesn't control this, okay? Once you appoint someone as a beneficiary on those documents, it stays, okay? And it doesn't matter what your will says. And so if you have a divorce or somebody predeceases you or things change and you forget about that designation, you know, you could have a result that you're not, you know, real happy with, or your family's not real happy with down the road. So the point of this is to revisit these designations about once every 2 or 3 years and just make sure they're updated. You can change them, but once you pass away, you're stuck with them. And so even though you have a will that may say something else. So let's go to the next one, next slide. Power of attorney. This is a document that can help you really when, you know, like for me, my parents are in their 80s. They've gotten to the point where they need some help with their finances, okay? I have their power of attorney. And so I've used this document to help out with their checking account, help out with their insurance matters, help out with credit cards and other issues that I've seen. So this document authorizes you to authorizes someone that you trust to manage your financial and legal affairs if you are unable to. So if you become incapacitated or disabled, this person can kind of take over and handle your affairs. This is a very important document. Again, in the bank, I can tell you we're seeing a lot of these because the baby boomers are getting older. You know, and look, it's okay to get some help. It's a very confusing world out there. And there's a lot of fraud that's going on. And it helps to have someone else help you kind of go through, you know, your finances and kind of go through your mail and just make sure that you don't fall into any scams. Because we're seeing a lot of scams out there these days, and they're hitting you from, you know, snail mail to email to text to calls. And it's just, it helps, especially when you're starting to get confused, to have someone that you trust that can help you manage your affairs. So let's go to the next slide. I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about just some of the components of powers of attorney. One is, again, you're appointing an agent or an attorney in fact to act on your behalf. Durability, they need to be durable powers of attorney. That means that when you have an incapacity or a disability, it's still effective. You know, it's best to go ahead and have the power of attorney effective at the time that you sign it. But you all want them to be durable powers of attorney. You want the general powers you want to give to that person. We're typically dealing with real estate, banking, business, insurance, retirement, taxes, and other such assets. Those are good powers to give away. Something to think about. You want to be careful with and limit your power of attorney for changing beneficiaries, changing your will. That can get a little tricky, okay? So the hot powers you just need to be careful of: gifting, trust changes, beneficiary designations. It's better to, you know, have specific authorizations for things like that. So, and again, I'm going to race through this, and I'm going to try to have at least 10 minutes for Q&A. So, but this allows for good third-party reliance to where you can continue to do your business even though you're just not in a good state to be able to handle it on your own. And of course, powers of attorney, they can be revocable at any time. So, but again, you have to treat them with care, but they can be a very effective tool, and they can be as far as taking care of the business of your loved ones. All right, let's go to the next slide. Healthcare directives. How many of you have an advanced healthcare directive? Okay. Well, what is it? It's a document that names someone to make medical decisions for you if you can't speak for yourself. It also can state your own wishes about end-of-life care so that person isn't left guessing. Again, this is a document sometimes we like to put off, but it's just so much easier to do it while you're of sound mind and you're healthy, and that way, and you can go ahead and, you know, name a healthcare power of attorney or go ahead and list your wishes. This is actually a statutory form. You know, attorneys don't even draft these. They just copy the form straight from the statute, print it off, and you can fill it out and sign it. It does need to be it needs to have two witnesses or be notarized. So again, it does help to have an attorney look over it and just make sure you execute it properly. Let's go over some of these, the next slide. These are some of the parts of it. Again, you can appoint someone to make healthcare decisions for you, like a power of attorney for healthcare. You can also give very detailed instructions on what you want to happen when certain scenarios come up, and it kind of guides you through that. It also designates, you can designate your primary physician. There's a part in there about organ and tissue donation. And of course, you know, you can have a future effective date or explain what you want to happen once you become incapacitated. So again, these need to be signed and either witnessed by two adults or notarized. And look, I see a lot of people in Mississippi, they combine the health care power of attorney with their financial regular powers of attorney. You can do that, but think about this. You know, these documents, you can ask Reed and some of the doctors around here, these documents will sit in your medical file. So you may not want your financial power of attorney sitting in your medical file. So a lot of times it's just easier to just split them apart and have two separate documents. And I think the state of Mississippi favors that. So they have this form that's ready for you and very helpful. So, all right, let's go to the next. Okay, last but not least is the family financial conversation. Like I said earlier, the best drafted documents are useless in a filing cabinet that no one knows about, okay? If your spouse or your oldest child is scrambling to find your will and they can't find your will, they're going to be hard-pressed to prove it. It's going to become more expensive if they're trying to prove, you know, open up your estate transfer things. So you need to have that conversation to talk about all these documents and even more, you know, why you're doing this. Because you're really doing it because you care about your family. You care about your children, your surviving spouse, and you want them to know how, you know, that you want them to have order, you want them to have clarity, and you want to avoid conflict. Because I can tell you, some of the worst cases we run into as attorneys are estate fights. Estate fights are awful. They're like really, really bad divorces. And it's very contentious because it's all personal. It's all inner family. Someone's either been left out of a will or, you know, older parent decides, hey, I'm giving all my money to James Dobson or whoever, you know, and disinheriting the family. You know, these get very personal and they can be very costly to your estate and to your family. So the best thing to do is have the conversations before, or, you know, beforehand and lay out your plan, you know, in paper so everybody knows what's going on. So, and again, this is a great time to just, you know, you can even talk about your funeral. You can talk about your spiritual values, things, the legacy that you want to leave to your family, to your children. So, next slide. So, none of this is really about death. It's about love made practical and stewardship carried all the way through. So all these things, these are just the mechanics, but what they do is remove confusion and conflict from the people you love at the moment they can least afford either one. So what I encourage you to do, in these classes, they've always kind of want you give you action points. I would think about a few things. If you have young children and do not have a will, you need to think about your will immediately, okay? You need to at least be able to designate your guardians and how your children are going to be taken care of. That's probably one of the most urgent things you can do. How many of you have a will but haven't seen it in the last 2 years? Okay. How many know where your will is? It's good to just every year or so, you know, I tell people a lot of times around tax time, when you're looking at your taxes, good time to look at your will, your powers of attorney, things of that nature. Good time to kind of review these, know where they are, know where the copies are, make sure things are up to date. And look, one will, when you have a will in your upper 20s or early 30s, you know, that will may need to change when you're in your, you know, mid 50s. So it's good to regularly review those and update them when you need to. So, And also, another thing to do is look at your beneficiaries on life insurance, annuities, retirement accounts. Just, you know, keep up with those from a year-to-year, you know, yearly basis. That can be really helpful when the time comes for those to, you know, come into play. So, questions? Yeah, if there's nothing on the title of that card that indicates it can pass to her on her death, you know, if it's in her name, she's fine. If it's in your name, if all your property passes outside already automatically, and even your bank accounts are set up, everything just automatic, then you don't necessarily. Now, the car may be an issue for you. You know, you may have to probate just that one thing. Yeah, because everything else is outside the estate. It's already transferred automatically. Yeah. Yeah, paid on death. You can designate certain accounts as paid on death. That way, you know, if the account owners pass away, it can automatically go to that other person. You know, certain accounts, you can do that. It's a good thing to ask your bank. Sometimes it's better just add them to the account. You know, if, you know, especially, you know, I got added to my parents' account probably 3 or 4 years ago just because they knew they were getting up in age and that they knew at some point they would need some help. So they just added me to the account. But that's a, you know, it just helps to, you know, it always helps to have those designations or ask your institution, whoever you're dealing with, about those designations. Yeah, I didn't mention that, but if you wait too late to do your power of attorney, they may not, you know, you may not be competent enough to, you know, execute one, because you have to be of sound mind and have enough lucidity at the time that you execute it for it to be valid. I always, you know, because all the powers of attorney that go through our bank come through across my desk. So I see a lot of them. And before I got there, I drafted a lot of them. But one of the things I look for is the date on when it was executed and what the person is saying, why they need it all of a sudden. And if it's like they executed last week and now they're now they don't have capacity, it kind of raises a lot of questions. And the problem is you wait too long, you have to go and get a conservatorship, and that's where you know, the court will decide, you know, who that person is, and then you got to make a regular accounting to the court. So it can be a lot more difficult, a lot more timely. And so try to do it sooner the better. It is part of, you know, the good thing about going to an attorney to talk these things out is I have that conversation a lot, you know, because people ask me, you know, all right, I got to set up a guardianship. Also want to set up a trust, a children's trust to take care of my minor children, you know. So I got to designate a trustee too. So do they need to be the same people? Do they need to both be in the family? You know, how do I choose? A lot of it depends on the age of all your kids. If all of them are minors, obviously I would look to close family members like siblings. Sometimes it can be parents. And, you know, one issue I think I have a lot of discussions with is, well, can the trustee and the guardian be the same person? And that's just really up to you. I suggest a lot of times when there's any doubt, it's not bad to have two people involved in your children's lives, one to kind of help out as a trustee and another one the guardian. So it's not bad as long as those two people get along. But again, you're in the best position to probably see if there's any kind of conflict between those two or if they don't get along. And sometimes it is better to have the same person. Sometimes it's better to have, you know, and look, if you don't have competent people that you trust in your family, then, you know, I've very often seen people go to their best friends or, you know, every now and then you see an attorney, you know, I kind of cringe when an attorney gets in that position. But somebody that they can trust is really the most important thing. So, yeah, you're kind of getting, yeah. That's where you really need to sit down and kind of plan for, you know, nursing home situations where you're trying to get Medicaid to help pay for it. There's certain rules. There's look back rules with Medicaid. You know, that really gets tricky. Another way to transfer property is you were referring to is what's called a life estate. You can give somebody a life estate in the property, and then the remainder can go to you or to someone else, you know. So that's another way to do it, but it has its own set of problems. And so that's just, again, something else that you want to talk to your attorney and your family about.
How long is look back on trust?
I've heard 5 years. Yeah, huh? I've heard 3 and 5. I think it's probably closer to 5. I mean, look, my theory is if you're going to get the federal government involved to help pay for anything, they're going to dictate kind of the rules, and they're going to look back and recapture. So if you're going to go that route, you got to carefully plan it and get a specialized attorney to help on that. How long is the look back for Medicare, you know, or Medicaid, I forget which one, when you're dealing with paying for nursing homes? You know, they can go back and she said it's 5 years. That could be. I think 5 is a good number, but, you know, again, I wouldn't be surprised if it's longer. So we're about up. Any other questions? That's another good point. And I tell a lot of my clients over the years, have a letter or a document that shows where all your assets and debts are, spreadsheet, anything to help out your executor, and show it to them. The more work you do for them, you're going to save them a lot of heartache when, you know, they should be grieving, and you want to give them enough time to grieve your death. But if you're giving them a lot of unnecessary work, it just makes it harder on them. So, hey, let me pray for us, and then we'll go on. Father God, I thank you for this day. I thank you that you allow us to come together as a church family and worship. We thank you for these kinds of talks that get us thinking about money and faith and stewardship and loving our family and just thinking through issues we don't normally think through. But God, give us the boldness and courage to have good conversations with our family about these issues and to not delay. And we pray that you would be with us as we go throughout our day. In Jesus' name, amen.